Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with USU alum Peter McChesney. Inspired by his experiences in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, coupled with his career background at the forefront of the AI revolution, his new book, Quintos Challenge, poses the question, what if science and religion collided and resurrection became a present reality? With immortality, would humans take a step forward toward an equalized collaborative utopia, or would we become a more stratified, controlled than ever? Before graduating from Utah State University with a master's in political science and bachelor's in law and constitutional studies, Peter McChesney went on to become an associate manager with Tesla Autopilot. He's led teams that train some of the world's most advanced AI and has worked as an adjunct professor of U.S. history and political science. Peter McChesney, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
So, distinguished career, very interesting project now with this book, and I think it's planned to be a series, right? So, I want to start with USU. I'm sitting here in Logan. We're broadcasting statewide, worldwide, as I like to say, on upr.org as well. But grew up in Australia, so what brought you to Logan, Utah?
Yeah, it's a bit of a jump. But the long story made short is on my mother's side, I'd always had family in the US. So I was fortunate to come and visit them when I was a teenager. They would visit occasionally in Australia. And so there was a strong bond formed with them from some other activities. I also had other connections in the United States. And so when I was attending the University of Western Sydney in my early 20s, I realized that I had an exchange partnership with Utah State University. So that allowed me to catch up with family, not have to take a break from studying. But during that 1 year of study abroad at Utah State, it was such a great experience. I fell in love with Cache Valley, with the campus there, with the people there. It was a very different type of university experience than what I was having in Sydney, which was a commuter school versus the college town of Logan. So all of those things combined to make me not only do that 1 year of study abroad, but continue on as a regular international student, finishing up a couple of additional degrees there. Met my wife there and traded the beaches of northern Sydney for the snowy valley of the Rocky Mountains. Sometimes come January, February, this time of year, I regret it when those snowy days come, but otherwise it's been a wonderful, it was a life-changing event for me going to Utah State.
I pulled up an old article from the Utah Statesman, the student newspaper at Utah State University. It's called A Day in the Life of Peter McChesney. You were student body president at the time. There's a picture of a very young Peter McChesney. Tell me about that life. Student body president, getting your master's degree.
Yeah, gosh, in some ways it certainly feels like several lifetimes ago now. There's marriage, kids, and everything in between since then. And so, but when I do reflect back on that time, it was just a wonderful experience to get even deeper into the college environment there. The reason why I wanted to get into some extracurricular work is that I felt like I wasn't necessarily firing on all cylinders. The study abroad program was great. I was enjoying the classes and everything, but I saw some opportunities to get involved there on campus, which ultimately led to 1 year being elected student body president. So it was a great honor. It was a great experience to be able to represent the students, work closely with college administration. Stan Albrecht was the university president during my time there, so it was a privilege to get to work closely with him. And that was right at the time when the university was embarking on its capital campaign. So I saw kind of the early days of that. I would graduate, a couple or so years later. And when I first visited the campus again several years after that, I saw what the fruits of that capital campaign were. The campus looked notably different with a lot more construction, a lot more resources and everything. But it was a great experience. Even had the opportunity through being ASUSU president. I think they may call it something different now. I think it might be called USU AS president or something. I'm not really sure, but I think it had an acronym change. But I haven't had the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C., even go to Israel. So many great things that came from that. And it gave me a look into public service as well and how that works, locally here in Utah. So only positive things to say about it.
Was there culture shock? I don't know with the, obviously Australia, different culture. Now you'd come to the U.S. and Utah.
Yes, so definitely some cultural differences. whether it's going to the US or the other way around, Americans going to Australia, probably the first initial things that you are aware of is that you're driving on a different side of the road than what you're used to, which can be a little bit unsettling at times, just depending on how you are you're first introduced to it. Obviously, the accent is something which is very noticeable. But outside of that, probably for me personally, I had never been in snow in my life. The closest I had come to snow was being in the Australian state of Victoria and seeing a little bit on some mountains at a distance. My first day entering Cache Valley, I remember a friend of mine was driving us through Sardine Canyon. And then I think there's been some construction since, where they've had some barriers between oncoming lanes, to make it a little bit safer. But there was nothing like that then. And we were driving through Sardine Canyon in quite a heavy snowstorm. And so that was obviously a first. And then the next day, there was, I believe, roughly a foot of snow or something like that, a very large amount of snow. So for somebody who had grown up on the beaches a little bit north of Sydney and then having to walk to class early in the morning through all of that, that was another thing which was obviously unique and something you'd never experienced. But to get to your question about the culture, obviously there's some cultural differences. Utah, obviously, with its history and heritage, being founded by the Mormon pioneers, and still being obviously the place where the LDS Church has its headquarters and high density of active members. I mean, honestly, I found the community in Logan, which I was a college student, and around college, other college students, but I got to know some of the families that lived there, and it was just a wonderful place. So yes, things that were unique to LDS culture were certainly in abundance, but I considered that a very positive thing.
So your degrees at Utah State University, law and constitutional studies, right? Political science, law and constitutional studies, fascination with political science. How do you go from that to AI and Tesla?
Yeah, I think we could back up a little bit and how I went from an initial degree of writing and publishing to law and constitutional studies, because I'm a first generation college student. So when I started my university career at the University of Western Sydney, as mentioned, I didn't necessarily have any family precedent to follow or any guidance necessarily from the family. I'm also the only child of my parents. So I was kind of the trailblazer in the family of going to university. Some basic things about how certain aspects of university GPA and grading, all that stuff was new to me. I had to, just experience that for the first time. And so without that, perhaps guidance or at least a trail to follow in the family, with all the variety of different degrees that I could do. And one thing was I did have a wide variety of interests, but the degree I selected, first of all in Sydney, was communications with an emphasis in writing and publishing, because I'd always loved stories. I'd always loved creating stories ever since I was a child. Most people love movies. I was certainly no exception there, particularly sci-fi movies. You can see one of my childhood influences on the wall behind me there with Star Wars. So anyway, long story short, I chose writing and publishing as that initial degree. And so that was what I was doing when I did my year of study abroad at Utah State. It was a continuation of that degree. But as I was exposed to some other things on campus at Utah State, even at the John Huntsman Business School, I was considering doing some business classes for a while, which I did. But after I had some exposure to some more general classes, particularly a U.S. government class, I absolutely loved it. I fell in love with it. It was almost like a conversion to wanting to understand those principles in the Constitution and learn more about it. So that's actually what transitioned me from kind of the writing and publishing, and it's a bit of a dabbling in the business school, to doing the law and constitutional studies degree. It ended up being a second bachelor's because I did complete the writing and publishing degree. I was pretty far into it at the time. But so that's how that transition happened. But getting to your other question, how does that make the jump over to AI? When I did get married, obviously there's a process to go through to get the green card. Without bogging you or the listeners down with all the details on that, there were some mistakes that were made in paperwork at the government's end and some other things which caused a significant delay. And so when that finally got resolved, I wasn't able to work in the meantime. I could have went back to Australia and worked, but it would have made the whole process have to start over again. And so I'm following the rules 100%. I can't make any money. I can't do any work. So when the opportunity for work finally came, when things were processed, I took the first job that was available, which was a sales job, and it was actually a sales job selling into the UK overnight time. So it was not the initial start to a working career that I imagined, but that shift didn't last for too long. But that led into a business-to-business sales career, which proved to be very beneficial for my family, getting a family started, all of those things. And as a part of the business-to-business software sales career, which it kind of coalesced around, some of that involved some early AI. And so I worked for a company called HireVue, which some folks here in Utah will certainly be familiar with, and certainly people around the world are familiar with that name in HR technology. And they pioneered some early AI in the HR technology space. So that gave me some exposure there. Had similar experiences in some other HR tech companies, which ultimately led me to working for a time at Tesla and Tesla Autopilot, working on the software which is commonly known as full self-driving, and which also, of course, underpins the robotaxi, which launched last year.
Let's jump into the to the book. As we'll see later how everything in your life kind of intersects with the book. So again, if people just joined us, Quinto's Challenge is the book. It poses the question: what if science and religion collided, and resurrection became a present reality? What would humans do with immortality? So where did this idea come from?
Yeah, you're right that those career experiences and other life experiences certainly blended together and emerged in what became the novel. But I think it comes from both curiosity and experience. On the curiosity side, ever since I was a kid, I was always fascinated with questions like, what exactly is consciousness? Could it ever be artificially created like you see in science fiction? What would artificial intelligence be like, in the distant future? Is it true what some people are saying that it is an existential threat to humanity? Or is that overblown and maybe the truth is somewhere in the middle, or maybe it's going to end up being benign? On the life experience side, my mother raised me more with a religious understanding of things. My father, on the other hand, had more of a secular worldview. And so I had the opportunity to be exposed to both growing up as a kid. And there was certainly a time where I was full-time into the religious mindset. And I think that gave me a great North Star in life. I mean, there's so many positives that came from that. I could certainly elaborate on that for a while. But one thing I found very interesting is that particularly such as in the LDS faith, where it might be thought of that there's no real miracles, so to speak, outside of science. It's really anything that might be termed a miracle, it would be ultimately something that we just don't understand. We just don't have the knowledge of, but obviously God would. And so it made me think, well, what would the type of science look like that would actually bring about resurrection and immortality? If you were kind of to combine the religious and the secular, what would that look like? I think that would be a really fascinating story to explore, particularly if you could bring back a whole variety of interesting people. But B, if that godlike power was available to humanity, what would that mean? We all know power corrupts, and ultimate power can completely corrupt. And so if that power does exist, how could it work? Now, of course, I'm not just talking about the power to raise the dead in the novel. The power that brings that about actually has an alternate application, which is very tempting to governments. It ultimately can be the ultimate spying weapon. And how exactly that works, I won't spoil anything in the book. But that's something that could really tear civilization apart at the seams. So I thought all of that would be a very interesting story. The science behind something that has ultimately been in the domain of religion, how would that ultimately work? Particularly given that some religious faiths think that ultimately it would be a science-based thing, but God knows how it works. We just don't. And how would that impact society in a whole variety of different ways, particularly when that power could be abused for other things. So there's more in the book there than that, of course, but that's kind of the seed or the genesis, if you will.
So that is an interesting juxtaposition of science and religion, right? And that's a theme through the book, as you say. For some who have religious faith, it is a it's a mystery. They're content to have it a mystery, right? A very hopeful component of their faith, right? That all will be we will be resurrected, though we will die, we'll live again, right? Immortality. But I guess for others, it is kind of a little more scientific framework. And as you mentioned, some religions kind of blend the two.
Exactly. It's the thought about how that could be an interesting story rested with me for some time, and so in between family commitments, demanding jobs, of which my jobs were quite demanding, I chipped away at it. The idea first started to percolate in probably 2015. I started to put things together early 2016, never realizing working on it just part time like that would take as long as it did, because I certainly wanted to incorporate all the themes that I wanted to into the book. I wanted to make it as polished as it needed to be. But for a while there, I always thought, oh, this will probably be several months away. Little did I know it would take a chipping it away at it for a decade for it would to fully come full circle.
And as you say, the potential downsides to this, I guess, I've always thought of resurrection, an unqualified positive, right? We die, we live again, immortality, right? But it's very interesting to take this, especially from a scientific point of view, and to explore maybe there would be some negative possibilities if humans achieved immortality, irrespective of religion.
Yeah, Quinto's Challenge introduces a lot of these themes and questions to explore. The larger Dawn of Immortality series is intended to flesh them out and explore them more fully. But perhaps just to set some things for the stage for the listeners, it's called Quinto's Challenge because Quinto is a US president in the mid 21st century. And on the 100th anniversary of JFK's challenge to land a man on the moon, President Quinto challenges America with a much more audacious goal: conquer death before the century is out by making human resurrection a scientific reality. And so, as the 21st century draws to a close, advances in artificial intelligence, advanced genetics, and quantum mechanics converge to make Quinto's challenge possible. And so, that is what I was wanting to do to kind of make this a reality. It's basically another moonshot. And as I've studied the history of science, a lot of the greatest endeavors that have come about have taken public backing to get going. Whether it's some public work system, whether it's the space race, or whether it was the Human Genome Project, some of the most audacious and most inspiring and amazing feats of science and engineering required public backing first. And particularly, I mean, I think the moonshot was the biggest example here. As I said, I put the narrative to make Quinto give his challenge on the 100th anniversary that JFK gave his moonshot challenge. And when the US Congress, in a fictitious world such as Quinto's challenge, or in the real world, can allocate resources and direct public policy towards amazing science, wonderful things can happen. And so, as far as setting that stage and moving on to what you had asked about, what could some of the negatives be? As said, Quinto's challenge introduces some of these things, but it does touch and raise a whole variety of other things. Now, some of the things that get debated in the novel are who would have the right to choose who gets to come back? Is it the US government? Who gets to have that right? And under what criteria should people be brought back? And if they are brought back, what about population growth issues? What about rights? I mean, our economy, our laws are all built around that people are here once and then they move on. If somebody comes back, what type of rights should they expect, particularly property rights and others, voting rights, everything else? You know, so there's certain challenges there. There's the question of what if somebody did not want to come back? So all of these things are introduced. And of course, there's the, as I said, the actual technology that powers this, which has alternate applications. You know, whenever there's a great power, there can be some very nefarious use of it. You can think of nuclear power, which can, you know, potentially have the power to give abundant energy to the world. But if nuclear power is put in the wrong hands, we know what type of tragedy can happen with that. So it explores that theme as well. The greater the power, the greater the potential for abuse. And so some of those things will get explored a little bit further into the next entry in the series.
Yeah, fascinating. Let's take a break. We're over two for a break. We'll come back much more with Peter McChesney. His new book is out. It's called Quinto's Challenge. It's planned first in a series, posing this fascinating question: what if science and religion collided and resurrection became a present reality? We'll have more following this brief break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Peter McChesney. Excuse me. He's a graduate of Utah State University. He went on to become associate manager with Tesla Autopilot, led teams that trained some of the world's most advanced AI. He's also worked as an adjunct professor in U.S. history and political science. Grew up in Australia. His new book is called Quinto's Challenge. It poses this fascinating question: what if science and religion collided and resurrection became a present reality? What would humans do with immortality? And so we're talking about that on the program today. Tell me a little bit about Dili, this young woman we introduced at the beginning of the book, travels to Particle City, I think it is, in Ohio. This is a project from President Quinto's moonshot, right, I think, right? Fascinating, this world that that we're introduced to with Dili, including a talking car that drives her in, Cork Tower that she goes to live with, humans coming and going from Europa and Titan, which are moons of Jupiter or Saturn. And clean energy rules right now. Tell me a little bit about this world that you created.
Absolutely. So, as mentioned, Quinto gives his challenge in the 2060s, but the main part of the narrative takes place in the late 2090s. And so, yes, it's an age where, you know, AI has not only advanced to artificial general intelligence, or AGI, which obviously the world's leading AI companies now are in a big race to try to build, for better or worse. But it's also an age where AGI's successor is around, and it's referred to as manufactured sentience, the dawn of literal, conscious, sentient, thinking, feeling androids. And so, very different world than what we have today. Computing devices have all also coalesced into one very common consumer device. So with our smartphones, our tablets, our laptops, our desktops today, they have really coalesced into wearable contact lenses that are augmented reality, or they have virtual reality capability. They wirelessly pair with the mind, so there's no need for a physical implant. This one actually wirelessly communicates with the mind and can convey audio to the ears. And so the world is filled with, you know, folks that wear devices like that, where they can think, they can open their apps, they can get augmented reality data points on what they're looking at, and so on and so forth. So that's kind of the late world of the 21st century. And as you pointed out, the main character of the book, Dili Carr, this is the world that she grew up in. You are correct. She starts out because she is fortunate to have landed a job with the Center for Advanced Particle Research, or CAPER, as it's the acronym is, and that takes her to the fictitious city of Particle City in Ohio. Now, CAPER was basically You could think of that as a much larger, much more powerful version of CERN in Switzerland with their particle accelerator there. Off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly what the circumference is of that one, but the circumference of the one that that the big super collider that Dilly goes to work at is 81 miles. And so it's a very advanced version of what we have on in Switzerland today. And so that super collider really was the physical thing that emerged from Quinto's challenge. He believed that the secret to unlocking immortality was not just advanced genetics, of course, and some things that go into cloning there, but to discover the remaining secrets of physics in the quantum world, where he believed, along with some others in the book, that everything that's ever happened in the three spatial dimensions we live in is recorded and encoded in space-time somewhere, somehow. And he believed if they had a device more powerful enough to be able to find that out, that final secret could be cracked. And so there's been some advanced androids and many other physicists working on it, but it hasn't been cracked. But Dilly Carr is a young, shy, aspiring quantum physicist who, by some luck, gets hired there and is working on that problem. So that's a little bit about the background there and kind of what sets the story up.
Now, a lot of this is based on real-world physics of today, right? You mentioned the Hadron Collider and others. Maybe mention some other things that you infused into the book from actual physics of today.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things which does get elaborated on a little bit in the book, particularly by Quinto himself, is the principle of quantum mechanics. And of course, I'm speaking about this as an author of science fiction. I'm not speaking about this as somebody who's a trained physicist or anything like that. And even for trained physicists, they obviously will admit the quantum world has more mysteries than we can comprehend. However, they do speak of a principle that is the preservation of information. That information is fundamentally never lost or destroyed. Now, obviously, there's some physicists that have different theories about how that could work, particularly with black holes. But that was one of the principles, because if something like that is true, that I go and drop a basketball and dribble it and throw it up and make a shot, the energy that went into that, the motion, all of the movements, and the preservation of all of that information is still somewhere there in the universe. Then you could extrapolate that out to say that, well, the arrangement of our neurons in our brain, the synapses, everything that makes us who we are fundamentally, would also be recorded somewhere, somehow. Of course, our physical bodies are here, but with our complete genome and advanced cloning in the future, people could be cloned and brought back. So obviously, that's some liberties that the fiction takes in the book. But that principle of that unit, that information is fundamentally preserved and cannot be destroyed in the universe, underpins some of the science that takes place, particularly at that super collider, or the Panhadronic super collider, as it's called, that the fictitious city of Particle City that is emerged to facilitate the scientists and all the staff and folks that that staff that.
Of course, this all keys on human nature. That you've leapt us forward to the 2090s, but the good and bad—it's in us, right? And where this could go is in us. It's human nature. You have some very hopeful things here, right? Where science has produced wonderful advances. I wonder how you square that with a strain of anti-science that certainly seems ascendant right now. I guess you're betting on the good side of human nature, that we come together to solve some of these problems.
You raised some good points. So yes, the book certainly takes a very positive approach to technology. It certainly references some challenges that took place in the 21st century between now and where the narrative takes place. But it doesn't focus on those. It does focus on some of the outcomes that we were able to use technology, and fortunately with some policy, even though some policy came a little bit later, to tackle some of the green climate issues and some other things that that have been referenced. But yeah, it's there is certainly a strains of anti-science today, and the book continues some of that in the late 21st century as well. The divide there is mostly for those people who are for and against the introduction of manufactured sentience into the world. And both sides have some very good points. AI has certainly displaced jobs. It hasn't displaced jobs at the rate at which some politicians in the book say it has, but it has displaced jobs. And then introducing the sentient androids, you know, does take that further. And so now, while all the advances from automation, AGI, and everything that the book has, the book makes some passing references to humanoid robots that were non-sentient, non-conscious before manufactured sentience comes. But it does make a passing reference to them. And all of those things were legitimately able to create a lot of wealth, so much so that there's a form of universal basic income. So I want to be clear, the book certainly doesn't pose the United States as a semi-socialist state. It's still a capitalist economy, but the innovations have been able to generate so much wealth that there is the ability to have this universal basic income. It's called the supported class, and even state-sponsored androids are given to some folks to be able to do that. And a lot of people don't like that. They say it is taking away human dignity. People don't want to just be, you know, supported. They want to work, and they want to earn a living. And so that's kind of where the divide is. And there's also a strain of, you might say, anti-science divide among them as well, where there's a lot of distrust towards those people who are supporters of Quinto and his super collider and everything that was coming from that. But it does really fundamentally come down to how people feel. If people are in a circumstance in their life where they don't feel like they've got dignity, they don't feel like they've got purpose. Sure, they've got food, they've got clothing, they've got accommodation, because all of that is in such abundance and can be, you know, very easily made. But it really does explore, you know, what circumstances people are in and as to what they are supporting or not. But fundamentally, yes, it is very positive with what can be done with technology.
Like to bring that conversation about AI. Is it a benign or malign influence? It ultimately, some of the ethical considerations. I'd like to bring that forward to today, and just out a few years. I wonder what your thoughts on that. We're all wondering. We really can't see in the novel. You're kind of projecting your view of what could happen. But maybe talk a little bit more about today and just out a few years.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because there's a lot of people that very much dislike artificial intelligence, and they have some genuine reasons for it. Like there are some things that I don't like with how it's trained and how it's implemented. So for me, I very firmly believe it is wrong to take data that you do not own to train an artificial intelligence model. I think it is very unethical to breach copyright for people who have gone into creative works to, you know, take their creative work without permission and use that to train your model and financially benefit from that when other people have done all the hard work to do the creation of it. And other things such as using artificial intelligence to sow confusion and doubt. It's interesting because even though my books, you know, kind of starts with some things in the 2060s and then, you know, the main narratives in the late 2090s. Many things that I wrote about, which over the 10-year creation of time of the book, are coming about a lot more quickly than planned. The deep fakes, the, you know, you just type something in and you get a, you know, a video that's made, and how that can be used to influence politics and deceive people. I mean, those things are pretty bad, obviously. But in terms of, you know, where it's going, I think the truth is oftentimes in the middle. You have those folks that say, you know, if you build this and keep building it, it's going to destroy humanity. And you have other folks that say, you know what, it's just a bubble. You know, it'll correct itself soon, and, you know, it'll have some uses, and that's it. I think the truth is more so in the middle. And I think this is what a lot of people need to understand. Just as the world's most advanced supercomputer that can do however many quadrillion calculations a second or whatever it might be, it's really only as good as the software that's written for it. And the same it is for the most advanced artificial intelligence. It doesn't matter how advanced the AI is, it's only as good as the training data that it's given. And the training data is given to it by humans. Now, yes, there are some things now where AI itself is going to be able to automate training data and so on and so forth, but that didn't come out of a vacuum. It was set on a trajectory from humans. So I don't think we need to be, concerned that artificial intelligence is going to suddenly become conscious in a moment like that. I mean, it really is like a large language model. It really is the world's most advanced copy and paste machine, you might be able to say. You put in a prompt, it goes out there and copies little parts from all of its training data that humans have put in there and cobbles it together and spits it back out as something that really looks like, there was a brain behind it. And of course, there were ultimately human brains behind it, but it was just pasted together in a very good way. But I think a lot of the distrust comes from how the training data has been captured and how it's being pushed in so many different areas, just thrown out there without proper regulation, such as, the deep fakes that can influence politics and so on and so forth. I think things have got off to a bad start with those things, and that can blind a lot of people as to the positive benefits that AI can do. It can work wonders in medical imaging. There's even solutions out there in the market now that have repurposed a lot of time for doctors, so it can take the administrative burden of doctors where they have to take the notes for the patients, they have to enter things. AI can do that. So the doctor's time can be repurposed to more value-added activities, treating patients and healing the sick, so on. So there's a lot of positives out there. And I think, unfortunately, the way the industry has done it, human nature rushing to try to, win this and everything else, has put a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths and made some people, unfortunately, looking at directions other than where the technology can be put to good use.
One big worry, and you mentioned this earlier in the hour, is jobs. Do you think that'll be a big thing? AI eliminating large scale in a large scale way jobs.
It's interesting because it can depend upon the competitive landscape as well. I mean, this could lead to a bit more of an AI arms race, so to speak. And by that, I mean, you may have one company that has some automated innovation because of AI, and then the others in the space start, doing the same thing. And so it kind of levels the playing field a little bit more. And so then something else has to happen, and perhaps it didn't eliminate as many jobs as what they thought. So I think absolutely there's going to be some jobs that will certainly be made redundant as time goes by and the models are more perfected. I think that's going to be inevitable, but the degree to which it happens might be slower than what we think, particularly given that if one company does it, other companies can come in and do a similar thing, which might need once again the companies to pivot and do something else. So maybe there's always going to be a role for people, but it's going to be shaped, or those human roles will be shaped by how they have to maybe train the AI or come up with some new things or whatever it might be. So I think it may not be quite as dramatic as what some might say.
What's the likelihood, likely or not likely at all, or impossible that machines would achieve sentience or consciousness?
That's a question which I've always been fascinated by. It might be that question that maybe we never fully get an answer on, at least for a long, long time. If conscious does emerge purely from some type of physical process in the brain, from the neural network that's in there, then you could theoretically say yes, that could happen. If it's something deeper than that, which there are some physicists such as Roger Penrose who postulate that consciousness is actually from quantum phenomena that exist in the brain that we still don't fully understand, then if that's the case, having purely a physical neural network and even a very advanced one, something that mirrors like the organic thing we have in our brain, may not be enough. I mean, even the best neuroscientists today still don't know what consciousness is. There've even been some that have said there's nothing that we can see in the brain that gives us any reason to say that's consciousness in there and that's how it works when we don't know. And so I think it's a fascinating question. Maybe there is something that does go beyond what is physically in the brain. Maybe it is something in the quantum world. Maybe, what Roger Penrose, even though it's not considered, mainstream, it's just one of the theories that's out there by a very prominent physicist. maybe there is something that goes beyond the pure physical, and what might reveal that something that religion has, said all along could maybe be more true than what we thought.
So it leads us in the direction of my next question, which has to do with the meaning of life. And so I'll pose it this way: resurrection, immortality, right? In a religious context, well, then you have that whole construct, religious construct, and religious faith telling you what the meaning of life is, right? That tethers that to it. You're taking it over to a scientific point of view, positing that humans in the 2090s have cracked the code. They've through scientific means have achieved immortality. So I'm sure you've thought about the accompanying questions of meaning of life under that construct. Tell me about that.
For sure. I do want to point out that in the novel, even President Quinto himself makes the acknowledgement that perhaps the basic ideas of religion and prophecies of resurrection to come and all things will one day be revealed might be more true than perhaps what scientists have ever given enough thought to. And so that does get acknowledged there in the book. It's framed in a way to try to highlight the best of both and the foresight of both lines of thinking. But in terms of fundamental meaning, it does raise the question there. What if this is the only life we have, how do we make meaning from that? Hey, if life can continue on, if the future generations do crack these codes, so to speak, what does that really mean for us as humans and what to expect? So the questions that the book raises, some of those questions are addressed in this first entry. The others will be explored a little bit more as the series progresses. But I think everybody at the end of the day has to find out, what their meaning is, and hopefully that meaning aligns with being respectful and following the golden rule.
Let's take another brief break. Well, then we'll come back with a very brief final segment with Peter McChesney, his new book, fascinating book, first in a series called Quinto's Challenge. We'll have more following this. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Peter McChesney. He's the author of a new book called Quinto's Challenge, which poses the fascinating question: what if science and religion collided and resurrection became a present reality? What would humans do with immortality scientifically achieved? Want to get this in. It's very interesting. Dili is neurodivergent. Why'd you want to make her a neurodivergent person?
A couple of different reasons for that. I think, especially when I've read biographies of folks like Einstein, that some of those people we consider geniuses, obviously Einstein is often first and foremost that we think of, they fundamentally have probably a different neural architecture in some way that gives them great advantages in one area, but disadvantages in another. I remember reading, I think it was the Walter Isaacson biography of Einstein, if I remember correctly. This is quite some years ago, but Einstein lost in thought that he would be walking around and need help getting back home. Now that sounds like the most basic thing for a normal functioning person to be able to do is, all right, I better pay attention and actually go the direction I need to go. But his brain was such a way that he was lost in thought, and so I thought if you're going to have somebody who is going to be able to crack the remaining code of physics. Now, what Dili eventually comes up with her research is hailed as the theory of everything. It's hailed as the thing which harmonizes general relativity with quantum mechanics and more. That you probably have to have somebody that is similar to that who sees things a little bit differently and can see those patterns that others naturally can't. So that's the first thing. The other is that I think, at least in my lifetime, I think it's very important to just to understand that there is a spectrum of people out there. There are different neurotypes. Sure, there's what's called neurotypical, and then there's maybe neuroatypical. Obviously, there's people that more on the autistic spectrum or have ADHD and other these things. And I think If we keep in mind that everybody's neuroarchitecture is different, then we can understand behaviors better. Now, why is this person not paying attention? Oh, because the structure of their brain does not filter out distractions physically and from their subconscious as better as other people do. However, they can have advantages in other ways as well. So I think, at least in my life, there's some family members that have ADHD, and I've been able to experience and see how that works out, and I've been able to see the advantages that has as well. So I also wanted to incorporate that into a character so people can see that there's advantages to some of these, quirky ways.
This is a planned series. Anything you want to share about the next book in the series?
Absolutely. Book two has a rough draft done already because when I did Quinto's Challenge, it actually was too big. And so I realized there needs to be a spot where this ends. There was a good natural spot to end the first book, but there's a rough draft of the next one there, which will explore more of those questions about when the power to bring resurrection around enters the world. What are the positives? What are the negatives? Who gets to decide? How does it impact society? How does it impact laws and economics and the technology that underpins it? Is that inevitably going to be used to for power and control by political factions who would do anything to have its other uses? But tomorrow is actually launch day for Quinto's Challenge, so obviously a big milestone. And so there'll be some activities that go with the launch and promotion for a while, and then I look forward to continuing on. But I roughly see probably roughly five entries in the whole series.
All right. Well, finally, Peter McChesney, what do you hope readers take away from Quinto's Challenge?
Yeah, there's several things I hope they can take away. Firstly, I hope they find it to be a fascinating plot that makes them think about some of these deep questions as well, and where we are going with this technology. I hope that people can see that power, like whether it's AI or whether it's some other advanced science, is neutral in and of itself. It really comes down to how we choose to use it as a society. How are we going to regulate some of these tools that are coming in our world today? Or are we going to let innovation, completely, do its own thing and take chances on the consequences that happen? And also, if there's any folks that can't necessarily subscribe to the fundamental afterlife ideas of religion, and that could be a sad thing for them, well, maybe there's a secular hope in the very far future that maybe death is not the end when a theory of everything is finally found and we know what we're doing with it.
Our guest today has been Peter McChesney. He's a USU alum and author of the first book in a planned series. It's called Quinto's Challenge, launches, as he said, tomorrow. You can find Peter McChesney at petermcchesney.com. And as I said, the book launches tomorrow. Peter McChesney, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tom. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody, for listening to Access Utah.